Good morning, everyone. It's nice to be with you here this morning. Our topic for this morning is two votes in 4 days. The first vote was on November 25th, 1947. The second vote was 4 days later on November 29th. Both votes changed the fortunes of the nation of Israel for the better. Both votes were conducted at the United Nations and concerned the partition of what was then the land of Palestine. The first vote required a simple majority to pass, that is, more than 50%. This vote was an amendment to the borders of the proposed Jewish and Arab states, which you see pictured here. The second vote was a little bit different. It required a two-thirds majority, as it was a UN resolution. And UN resolutions require a two-thirds majority of all UN delegates. This vote would determine whether the world approved a standalone Jewish state, which would shortly thereafter become the state of Israel. It too would pass. Now we're going to read this little excerpt here. On October 10th, 1947, it was announced that the United States would support the partition plan. But the matter was far from straightforward. Two critical votes had to pass, and these are the votes we are speaking about this morning. The first, as the United Nations members voted, as the Ad Hoc Committee on the Palestinian Question did so on November 25th, 1947, by the margin of 25 votes to 13, with 17 abstentions and 2 absentees. Had this tally been repeated in the General Assembly 4 days later, the partition resolution would have failed since a two-thirds majority was required. The important thing to notice about these two votes is as follows. The first vote passed with a majority of just over 65%. That's 25 of 38. However, 65% is a little bit less than two-thirds. Thus, if the results from this first vote had been replicated 4 days later, the second vote would not have passed. Something must have happened to sway the vote. This morning, we wish to dig into some history books to identify several seemingly unrelated circumstances and events that can help explain why the second vote passed with a two-thirds majority. You will see on the screen that the second vote passed with 33 of 46 votes. Had this top number been 30 or less, the vote would not have passed. Thus, just 3 votes was a margin of error. Alternatively, a country that may have voted positively for the first vote could have voted negatively the second time. Since abstentions did not count in the voting percentages, another possibility is that a country that abstained from the first vote could vote negatively the second time, in which case getting 3 more favorable votes would not have been enough to get a two-thirds majority. The upshot is that we have a precarious situation from November the 25th to November the 29th. This subject may be better suited for a lecture, as it will inform more than exhort. Nevertheless, I hope that learning more about the these two votes in 4 days, and how one passed with a little more margin of error than the other one, I hope that by doing this, this can boost our faith that Israel is a key factor in the Bible's teaching about the kingdom of Israel being restored at the second coming of Christ. The purpose of this morning's talk is to identify how a two-thirds majority vote was obtained on November 29th, despite less than a two-thirds majority being obtained 4 days previously. To do this, we will examine some historical records. The payoff is that we will increase our faith that God is at work through the nation of Israel. Now, a spoiler alert, from the top right and going clockwise, you will learn how the second vote was indirectly influenced by a very wealthy Jewish man known as the Banana King, by a political revolt in what was then Siam, it's now Thailand, by stomach surgery of the ruler of Nicaragua, and by Harvey Firestone, founder of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company. But first, a little background from the Bible. The Bible teaches that the land of Israel is the most important real estate on earth. The land of Israel has been promised by God to Abraham and Abraham's descendants forever. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession. And I will be their God, as we read in Genesis 17. Once we are baptized, we are the adopted descendants of Abraham, which means that we have a vested interest in this land. We should be interested in this land for at least 2 reasons. Number 1, it is our eternal inheritance. And number 2, learning something about its past can boost our faith that God's promises about its future are certain to occur. To explain why the nation of Israel is still very relevant today, we will read two passages from the prophet Jeremiah. Although the ancient kingdom of Israel was terminated about 2,500 years ago, and the Jewish people were subsequently dispersed throughout the world, the Bible foretells a time when the Jews would return to their land. And we'll just read this passage here from the screen. I will restore the fortunes of Judah and the fortunes of Israel and rebuild them as they were at first. I will cleanse them from all the guilt of their sin against me, and I will forgive all the guilt of their sin and rebellion against me. And this city, Jerusalem, shall be to me a name of joy, a praise and a glory before all the nations of the earth, who shall hear of all the good that I do for them. They shall fear and tremble because of all the good and all the prosperity I provide for it. Thus says the Lord, in this place of which you say, it is a waste without man or beast, in the cities of Judah and the streets of Jerusalem that are desolate, without man or inhabitant or beast, there shall be heard again the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, the voices of those who sing as they bring thank offerings to the house of the Lord. Give thanks to the Lord of hosts, for the Lord is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. For I will restore the fortunes of the land as at first, says the Lord. For the fortunes of the land of Israel to be restored, the Jews would have to return to their land. The desolate wasteland of Israel would need to be transformed into something prosperous. Then all the nations of the earth would hear of the good that God would do for Israel. Today, as you can see pictured below, Israel is a thriving, prosperous country, vastly different from the barren wasteland it was about a century ago. The other passage we'll read is from Jeremiah 16, which we read this morning. Prophet Jeremiah states, therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it shall no longer be said, as the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them. For I will bring them back to their own land that I gave to their fathers. Today, the world Jewish population stands at 15.3 million. Just over 7 million Jews live in Israel. This fact is partial fulfillment of Jeremiah's prophecy that God would bring the Jews back to their own land that he gave to their fathers. An interesting historical question is, how did these fulfillments occur? How was it that an empty wasteland at the turn of the 20th century became a thriving homeland to the Jewish people in a relatively short time span? United Nations Resolution 181, which is what you see here on the screen in the Palestine Post, this was voted upon on November 29, 1947, and this was a key reason the barren land of Palestine became the thriving nation of Israel. As we previously mentioned, a two-thirds majority was needed, but the likelihood of achieving this majority hung in the balance, as a vote 4 days previously involving the proposed land borders of a Jewish state passed with one vote less than a two-thirds majority. The fact that this first vote did not get a two-thirds majority did not bode well for the outcome of the second vote. For the rest of the talk this morning, we will consult some historical sources to learn about some of the people and circumstances that shifted the vote in favor of Israel. We'll begin with a brief consideration of this gentleman here. His name is Samuel Zemuri. He was also known as the Banana King. The idea for this talk came from a book I read a few years ago, the cover of which you see pictured here. The book is entitled The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King. One paragraph in this book discussed the connection between the Banana King and the UN partition vote. Intrigued, I decided to investigate further. Samuel Zemuri, better known as Sam the Banana Man, or the Banana King, was born in January 1877 to a poor Jewish family in what is now Moldova, which borders the Ukraine. After his father died in 1891, 14-year-old Sam emigrated to the United States with his aunt and settled in the small and unassuming town of Selma, Alabama. There, nestled against the banks of the Alabama River, Sam's waterway, road to fortune began. He encountered bananas for the first time in Selma in 1893 and moved to the port of Mobile, Alabama in 1895 to go into the banana business when still a teenager. Now, bananas were not imported to the United States until 1876. When Sam moved to Alabama, bananas were still considered a new and exotic delicacy. Bananas would arrive by steamship from Central America, where they were unloaded at the port of Mobile, and then shipped by rail or ship to other U.S. destinations. Sam noticed piles of bananas in danger of being overripe, these were known as ripes, languishing on the docks. With a flash of entrepreneurial genius, he saw a niche market and capitalized on Alabama's growing appetite for this exotic fruit. He bought ripes by the bushel and established a network of agents in southern Alabama to sell bananas at major rail stops before they could spoil. Sam started with $150 in 1895, but 3 years later, when he was 21, had amassed $100,000, the equivalent of about $4 million today. In 1903, Sam signed a contract with the United Fruit Company, the dominant company in the banana trade, to buy and distribute United Fruit's ripest bananas. In 1905, Sam acquired a steamship company, which later became known as the Cayamel Fruit Company. Later, his company expanded into banana production. In 1910, Sam's company made its first real estate purchase in Central America and acquired 5,000 acres in Honduras. Business boomed, and in 1929, Sam retired after selling the shares in his company to his major competitor, the United Fruit Company, for $31.5 million just before the Great Wall Street crash of 1929. Now, they say to buy low and sell high. That's exactly what Sam did. Upon retirement, he was one of the wealthiest individuals in the United States. However, he was not finished. He received a seat on the board of directors of the United Fruit Company and bought up the discounted shares of this company until he had enough shares to become the majority shareholder. He became CEO in 1933 and led the company until his second retirement in 1954. His net worth was never known, but he went from extremely wealthy to extremely, extremely wealthy upon his second retirement. As an aside, the bananas that made Sam wealthy are not the Cavendish banana that you find in grocery stores today, but what were called the Gros Michel or Big Mike bananas, all but wiped out by a fungus in the 1950s. The key takeaway is that in the mid-1940s, there was a very wealthy Jewish man living in the United States. This man also had political connections in Latin America from his years of schmoozing and deal-making. Now, I'm going to read an excerpt next from this book here. The book is entitled The Jewish Presence in Latin America, and we'll just read this and then make a few comments. It says, the influence of the Latin American Zionists upon the vote of their respective governments on the United Nations resolution on Palestine of November 29, 1947, still has to be studied and assessed. At this point, however, it can be stated that the only important diplomatic achievement of the world Zionist movement since the ratification of the British mandate by the League of Nations in 1922 was rendered possible by the Latin American nations. They provided 13 out of the 33 votes cast in favor of the plan of partition of Palestine. Only one Latin American nation, which was Cuba, joined 12 other nations to vote against it, whereas the other Latin American countries were among the 10 abstaining. And here's the important part. Without Latin American support, the resolution would not have received the required two-thirds of the votes. So the point is that without Latin American support, the second vote we spoke of would not have passed. 13 of the favorable votes were from Latin America. 10 Latin American countries abstained, and only one, which was Cuba, was not in favor. Thus, of the 24 possible Latin American votes, only one went against Israel. Now, is there any evidence to link Sam the Banana Man with the favorable or neutral attitudes of Latin American countries toward Israel? There is some circumstantial evidence. Now, on the next two slides, we're going to read some paragraphs from our article, and then we're going to summarize. This is a little bit dense, what we're going to read, but I will summarize at the end. You'll notice a reference here to something called Bessarabia, which is a part of what is now Moldova. It's a geographical reference where Sam was born. So bear with me, please, as I read the next two slides. It says, as oblivious to Latin American sensitivities, as was the Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, when he contemptuously remarked that Israel was no banana republic, which earned him a rebuke from a friend of Israel and former ambassador in Jerusalem of banana export in Colombia, the UFCO, which is the United Fruit Company. This UFCO rubric is indicative of the Zionist hope, if not belief, that Central American support might be won through UFCO's president and largest shareholder, Samuel Zemuri. According to the British, Zemuri was a one-time Bessarabian fruit peddler, which is again a geographical reference to where he was born, whose shrewd and hard-headed business ability had pushed him to the top, including an advisory role in U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt's Foreign Economic Administration. More important to the Zionists was the fact that long before November 1929, when he became UFCO's foremost stockholder, Zemuri had been deeply involved in molding Central American events to suit his business interests. A sympathetic UFCO history highlights that his ascent from shop assistant in a small Selma store to banana entrepreneur in Honduras in the 1910s included a prominent part in the overthrow of President Miguel Davila. Indeed, Zemiri's search for special concessions and tax holidays in Tegucigalpa, which is in Honduras, led him to equip and finance an anti-Davila military coup, successfully staged by Miguel Bonilla, a former Honduran president exiled in the U.S., and assisted by some mercenaries. The operation won all the advantages sought by its aider and abettor. Introduced to Zionist elder statesman Chaim Weizmann, who was the first Israeli president in the 1920s, Zemiri found various ways of demonstrating his favorable disposition to the cause of Jewish sovereignty, including the purchase and registration of SS Exodus 1947. Now that's a ship, and we're going to say more about that in a few minutes. Thus, as an asset in the Zionist pocket, it was not unnatural that in October 1947, upon learning about Jewish agency anxieties concerning the Central Americans, Weizmann should have approached Zemiri. The situation is such, he informed the UFCO president, that your help is very much required at this critical stage. Believe me, it is urgent. Nevertheless, despite Zemiri's famous boast that in Central America, a mule cost me more than a deputy, he appears to have been generally unable to translate his company's position in Central America, especially in Honduras, the country where UFCO interests were most deeply entrenched, into votes for Jewish statehood. Now, that's a lot of information to try to absorb. It's the last detailed slide that we have. However, to summarize this, Mr. Zemiri had deep roots in Central America. He was an economic advisor to the U.S. government's Foreign Economic Administration after World War II. He had provided the financial backing for a military coup in Honduras. And he was friends with Chaim Weizmann, who was very influential in bringing about the establishment of the Nation of Israel. Thus, he had deep pockets. He also had political connections with both Latin America and the U.S. In a book containing the letters of Chaim Weizmann, there is a letter dated to Samuel Zemiri. It's October the 20th, 1947, about 6 weeks before the historic vote later that November. It says, I'll just read the note here. I arrived here a few days ago in connection with the meeting of the United Nations. The situation is such that your help is very much required at this critical stage. I've tried to get in touch with you, but so far have failed. Kindly let me know when we can meet. Believe me, it is urgent. With affectionate regards, your old friend, Chaim Weizmann. Now, when Mr. Weizmann asks Mr. Zemiri to help him, he was probably referring to financial help. Mr. Weizmann was not referring to the purchase of the SS Exodus, because that was purchased in the summer of 1947. Now, I'm going to read you another bit from our article here about bribes. This is kind of interesting. It says, heavy money bribes to swing more than one Central American republic in favor of partition are mentioned by an author named Michael Cohen. And what he goes on to say, it's that heavy money bribes may have been used, but we don't know that for sure. Anyways, Cohen's statement coincides with Zemiri's reference to Weizmann that, although too high for the Jewish agency's limited resources, the votes of all the countries from Guatemala to Panama could be bought. Now, if bribes were used to sway votes in favor of Israel, they would have had to come from a very wealthy individual with very deep pockets, and likely someone who had the political connections in Latin America. Sam Zemiri meets these criteria. It is not known for sure whether bribes were used to sway pro-Jewish sentiment in favor of Israel. But if so, Mr. Zemiri could have been the bankroll behind the bribes. Regardless, Mr. Zemiri was well-regarded in Latin America, his Jewish identity was known, and these factors could only have improved Latin American sentiment towards Israel. And if, in fact, a bribe was actually used, this wouldn't be something that we would know for sure in historical sources, because bribes would not be something that would be given into history books due to their clandestine nature. Now, we mentioned that Sam Zemiri had purchased the SS Exodus, which is the ship that you see pictured here off on the right. He bought the ship on behalf of an underground Jewish military organization known as the Haganah. In July 1947, this overcrowded ship carried over 4,500 Jewish men, women, and children, all Holocaust survivors, to Palestine, where they would illegally immigrate. However, before the ship could dock, British destroyers surrounded the ship and towed it into the port of Haifa in Israel. The passengers were then transferred onto Navy transports back to France. The French authorities refused to forcibly remove the refugees from the ships. Many of the passengers declared a hunger strike, which lasted 24 days and garnered world attention. The ensuing public embarrassment for Britain, which controlled Palestine, played a significant role in the diplomatic spring of sympathy toward the Jews and the support of the vote on November the 29th. Let's just read this excerpt here. It says, the Jewish agency was undoubtedly concerned with averting further casualties, securing quick medical treatment for the wounded, and perhaps preventing the exodus from capsizing. However, it also wished to extract the maximum publicity from the spectacle bound to ensue at Haifa, where agency representatives treated the members of the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine to a first-hand view, blow by blow, of British immigration policy. The whole affair, from the first engagement on board ship to the final manhandling of the refugees by British soldiers at Hamburg and their transfer to camps in the British-occupied zone of Germany, was conveyed to the world by a well-oiled publicity machine. The British and UK Prime Minister Ernest Bevin, in particular, were outmaneuvered at every step, and the inhumanity of Britain's Palestine policy and its refugee aspect was indelibly described in world public opinion. Now, just to summarize what that article was trying to say, because Sam Zemiri purchased this ship, ultimately the world became sympathetic to the plight of the Jews and their need for a homeland. Now, I don't expect you to be able to read anything on the next slide, but what you see here is a list of countries and the ones that were either in favor, opposed, or abstained or absent from both of these two votes that we discussed. The countries highlighted in yellow all changed their votes from abstentions or were not absent for the second vote. For sake of time, we will just briefly consider one of these countries and why it changed its vote, and that is Liberia, a small African country. Also highlighted in green is Nicaragua, which supported both votes, but was initially opposed to the partition plan. Finally highlighted in red is Siam, which was opposed to the November 25th vote, but was suddenly absent and did not vote 4 days later. Now, I'm going to read this excerpt here, and I want you to notice why Liberia changed its vote to support Israel. At the White House, there was a political advisor named David Niles, who had worked for both U.S. Presidents Roosevelt and Truman. He was particularly active in trying to garner support for Israel. Smaller countries such as the Philippines and Liberia came in for close attention. Liberia was especially vulnerable since its economy was dependent upon the export of its rubber to a single company, Firestone. Mobilized by former Undersecretary of State Wells, Harvey Firestone warned President Tubman of Liberia that unless his country changed its vote to support partition, the company might have to reconsider its plans for extending its holdings there. Liberia duly changed its vote. Several Central American countries were apparently offered heavy money bribes to change their vote. Again, we don't have any historical evidence about the bribes, but notice what happened to Liberia here. Mr. Firestone, who was Jewish, said to Mr. Tubman, if you'd like me to continue operating my company and bolstering the economy in Liberia, would you please vote for the partition plan here? And Mr. Tubman got the message. And just as an aside, not only was Harvey Firestone Jewish, but the family used to be German and it changed its name to Firestone from Feuerstein. Now, this next excerpt here is from a book called The Birth of Israel. It's written by a guy called Jorge Garcia Granados. He was from Guatemala. And he explains something here about Siam. So why would Siam, which was previously opposed to supporting this vote of Israel, it was suddenly absent? What's happened? This excerpt says, in the following 48 hours, the situation cleared up. He's referring to what happened just before the second vote. On Friday, the Haitian delegate told me with some relief that his instructions had at last arrived. His government favored partition. Paraguay's instructions were also favorable. Liberia's vote was assured because of the actions of Mr. Firestone. And finally, the Philippine ambassador in Washington instructed his delegate to vote for partition. Now notice this. Then fate herself took a hand. Because of a revolution in Siam, its delegation here had been disavowed by the new government. Its chief delegate, who had earlier supported the Arabs, left the United States. Siam had no bona fide representative and could not vote. Partition was assured. So because of this sudden revolution, the delegate had to leave the U.S. and was not physically present to vote. And that's what happened. Now, is that kind of thing just a coincidence or not? I would suggest not. another interesting thing here from a book called The Redemption of the Unwanted contains Nicaragua. The dictator of Nicaragua, his name was Somoza, had been suffering from severe stomach problems that required delicate surgery. Two friends, and both of these folks here were Jewish, Dewey Stone and his brother Judge Harry Stone of Brockton, Massachusetts, prevailed upon a leading Boston surgeon to take the case and to perform the delicate operation. Somoza did not forget the intercession of the Stones, and he brought his own and several of the Latin American countries into the affirmative line. So why did Nicaragua support the partition vote? It's because he remembered the work of these two Jewish men finding a surgeon that would heal him of his medical situation. On May the 14th, 1948, the State of Israel officially declared independence. However, without a two-thirds majority vote of the UN, on November the 29th, 1947, the State of Israel would not have been born. What caused nations that may have been sitting on the fence to change their vote? What else may have happened that led to the two-thirds majority vote? A Nicaraguan dictator required specialized surgery. Two well-connected U.S. Jews got a Boston surgeon to do the operation. Nicaragua supports Israel and may have influenced other Central American nations to do the same. An unexpected political coup in Siam between the 25th and 29th of November meant that Siam, which was unfavorable to Israel, did not have a delegate to attend the UN vote, as the delegate had to leave the U.S. and could not vote. Harvey Firestone, who was Jewish, told the president of Liberia that if he did not support Israel, the Firestone Company would no longer export the rubber it needed for its tires from Liberia. Liberia got the message and supported Israel. Less is known about Sam the Banana Man, who was Jewish. He bought the SS Exodus in 1947, which gave the Zionists a major publicity success and demonstrated to the world that the British had lost control over Palestine, thereby leading to a groundswell of support for the cause of a Jewish state. Sam was also very well connected in both Latin America, in the U.S., and with Chaim Weizmann. Whether Sam personally paid bribes to get Latin American nations on side of this vote is unknown, but is possible. Regardless, his Latin American connections due to his banana business may have been somewhat responsible for a favorable or at least a neutral attitude amongst 23 of 24 Latin American nations with voting privileges at the UN. So to summarize here, two votes in 4 days. Hopefully these anecdotes will boost our faith that God had a hand in the affairs of the nations of the world to ensure a prosperous homeland for Israel, for his people, as he had inspired the prophet Jeremiah to record for posterity, "I will bring them back to their own land that I gave to their fathers."